Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is the course on the Book of Acts, lesson number 9 in the series, moving right along. We will be in Acts chapter 7, verses 1 through 60, a lengthy passage, one that I hope to cover in a timely manner. I hope to, and I probably will fail. It's like, you know, joke preachers, I think it's two different things at the same time. You know, preachers say that, I promise not to keep you very long. It's the number one lie told in the pulpit. It's also a joke I heard, you know, that said the preacher was preaching, kept looking at his watch, and the little boy asked his dad, said, "What's he do? What does that mean? Why does he keep looking at his watch? What does that mean?" And the guy, and the dad says, Doesn't mean a thing, son. So, anyway, we're in Acts chapter 7. Title of the lesson is The First Martyr. We will look now at the message of Stephen, the sermon, speech, whatever you want to call it, that he is going to give before the council, which most likely appears to be the Sanhedrin. And we will then see the angry mob turn on him, and we will see him stoned, which also leads us to the very first appearance of probably the principal person in the Book of Acts, which is Paul. We will see his first appearance here also in this chapter. Now, to set this up, we look back and cover a little bit of ground from the previous lesson. The church has been growing leaps and bounds. We see that it has actually been multiplying according to chapter 6, verse 7. So exponential growth is taking place. A lot of people are believing and joining to the church. There were the 7 deacons that were elected and have started their ministry. Stephen is one of them. We see that he has been in chapter, also back in chapter 6, we see that he has been debating and preaching the gospel in the Jewish synagogue. So he has made some enemies. He's also very very effective, and that they could not combat his arguments. So basically, if you can't beat them, kill them. And so that's what they've decided to do. They've trumped up some charges, bribed some people to lie to bring them, and have brought him before the council on these charges of blasphemy, and with the aim to get this guy out of the way. I think this is one of those deals. I don't know why they went through the motions of giving it any type of legal standing. This is a lynch mob that brought him in. They knew what they wanted, and they are going to get their way with him. So the setting of this, we are still in Jerusalem. It is somewhere around the year 34 AD, so about 4 years after the crucifixion, after Pentecost. Now, that date is just one that I saw doing research. I can't guarantee that. It's just a good date to attach to it just for kicks. So take it with a grain of salt. This is a continuation, of course, of the last half of chapter 6, verses 9 through 15 specifically. So where we left off mid-story in that lesson, in our previous lesson, so we're going to pick that back up here. Now, this is also the longest sermon / speech in the Book of Acts. Now, we have sermons by Peter, we have sermons by Paul, but the longest one that is recorded is by Stephen, just as an interesting side note. And it's very easy to look at that because the chapter is 60 verses long. Now, not all of that is his sermon. And so, you know, we don't have to deal with 60 verses of him preaching. We will actually deal with about 50, I think 52, something like that, verses. It's verses 2 through 53. So you do the math. All right, so picking up where we left off, he has been brought before the council. The charges have been made, speaking blasphemy, verses 13 and 14 of chapter 6, and chapter 7, verse 1. Then said the high priest, "Are these things so?" So here we go. He's been offered the witness stand. He stands before the people. And I'm not really sure exactly how this worked. I picture something akin to an amphitheater type setting, kind of a semicircle fan-shaped auditorium with rising seats, and that, you know, with raised platform behind that where the high priest and such would stand. I just picture in my mind Stephen standing in front of this crowd and, you know, a little platform area in front of the high priest facing out to the council. And that's just the way I picture him in this setting, giving his defense of the charges. Now, before we get in, let's look a little bit at what Stephen is going to preach. Number one, it's going to be very long. Basically, what he does is go all the way back through Israel's history in laying a foundation that the new faith, or what seems to be the new faith in Christ, is really just a continuation of the Jewish of the Jewish faith. And that throughout history, the Jews have always resisted God in his work. So, you know, look, that's all he's at the end. He's saying, look, you guys, y'all crucified Jesus, y'all rejected Messiah. And he's going to point his finger at him. He gets very pointed at the end. And in a way, I think no wonder he is brought before the council and they're ready to kill him, because he evidently is a very fiery speaker. Now, it takes him a while to really get going here, but it's no wonder he made some enemies in debating, because he was not the most courteous, it seems like, because he goes right at them at the end, gets very pointed. So basically what's going to happen, though, is he is going to go all through Israel's history, starting with Abraham, and we get all the way up into Moses and David and Solomon, so up into the building of the temple. Basically, that's about, double check, but I believe that's about as far as we go. Yeah, about verse 47, so a lot of ground to cover, so I will quit rambling. I'm already a good ways into this, so let's just dive right in. Verse 2, and he, that's Stephen, said, men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. So listen up. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. Now, Bible spells in the New Testament, it looks like Charan, Quran, something like that. That's Haran in the Old Testament. And verse 3, and said unto him, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred, and come into the land which I shall show. Verse 4, then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land wherein he now dwells. So he's setting the foundations for the Jewish people here. Who is the father of the Jewish nation? It was Abraham. God called him out of his homeland, out of the Ur of the Chaldees, to come to this new land he had never seen, to be the father of a great nation that he really never got to see either. But through his faith, this people, the Jewish people, came to be. Verse 5, and he, God, gave him, that's Abraham, none inheritance in it. No, not so much as to set foot on. Yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession, and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. Verse 6, and God spake on this wise, that his seed should sojourn, I can't say it, in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage and entreat them evil 400 years. Verse 7, and the nation to whom they shall be in bondage will I judge, said God, and after that shall they come forth and serve me in this place. So, I kind of jumble things up together. Verse 5 talks about, of course, that inheritance he got, and that, you know, it was going to be a possession for his children. He didn't have any children. Verse 7 and 8 talks about the prophecy, or verse 6 and 7 talk about the prophecy that God revealed to Abraham what was going to happen, that his great-great-great-grandchildren, actually, great-great-grandchildren, something like that, are going to go down to Egypt. They're going to be down there. They're going to face hardships. They're going to be in bondage before they are able to go back into the land. But they are going to come out. Now, historians tell us, they've studied that, you know, the prophecy here is 400 years, and that it was something like 440 years, I think it was, that they were in Egypt. So it's very, very accurate, very close. And why is that different? I think because for about the first 40 years, they were not in bondage. It took a few years for them to be in bondage. Verse 8, and he gave him the covenant of circumcision. So that was the physical sign of being a Jew, was being circumcised. And so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him the eighth day, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat the 12 patriarchs. So we have Israel now set up. You know, Abraham has had Isaac. Isaac has had Jacob. We have the 12 tribes of Israel and Jacob's son. So we have the nation of Israel in its fledgling form there in Abraham's family tree. Verse 9. And the patriarchs moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him. Of course, we know that was true, how Joseph, you know, he was sold as a slave in Potiphar's house, falsely accused, goes to the prison. His own people he helps there forget about him. He eventually, though, ends up interpreting the Pharaoh's dream and becomes the second ruler in Egypt, wherein God uses him to save the nation of Israel. Verse 10, and delivered him out of all his afflictions, and gave him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his house. Verse 11, now there came a dearth over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance. Verse 12, but when Jacob heard that there was corn in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. Verse 12, and at the second time Joseph was made known to his brethren, and Joseph's kindred was made known unto Pharaoh. Let's see here. In verse 14, then sent Joseph and called his father Jacob to him, and all his kindred, 75 souls. So we have here, this is how Israel gets down into Egypt. That, of course, there was a famine. There's all this food that's been stored up in Egypt, thanks to Joseph, his interpretation of the dreams that Pharaoh had, through his administration, through his administrative skills. They have food. And so when there is this great famine, everybody's coming there for food because they're the only people that stored up food. In fact, this probably is what catapulted Egypt into a great international power, because you know, before this time, Egypt was not as powerful. They were, you know, a good regional power, but because of that trade, there's a lot of riches came in, and just made Egypt remain strong while other nations and kingdoms were just struggling for survival. Let's see. So verse 15, so Jacob went down into Egypt and died, he and our fathers. Verse 16, and were carried over into Sychem and laid in the sepulcher that Abraham bought for a sum of money of the sons of Emor, the father of Sychem. Which, by the way, if you do a little research, that tomb may actually still be there. There is a place that they claim that is that cave, and that those tombs are still there. I don't know, you know, hard for me to think in some ways that just a little unknown little cave family tomb would still be able to be found. But there is a place that tradition says is there. You can look that up and actually see some pictures and stuff of it. So we have Israel has now gone down there. The patriarchs have all passed off the scene. And Israel is now in Egypt, now in bondage. So now we've already set up Israel's origins. We've already got them into Egypt. Now we're going to get them out of Egypt. Verse 17. And this is really the lengthiest portion of this passage. Because you think about it, this is what really sets up Israel's identity. Separates them from Egypt, gets them into the land. In the process, they're given the law, they're given the tabernacle. So this really sets up Israel as a separate nation. It gives them their identity. And God really starts working with them once they come out of Egypt. So verse 17, but when the time of the promise drew nigh, that's talking about that prophecy God gave to Abraham, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose, which knew not Joseph. Which, history bears this out. This probably has something to do with the rule of a group of people called the Hyksos, who were not Egyptians. They were foreigners who came in and ruled, and either they were the Pharaoh that Joseph worked under, or they were this new king. It's a little sketchy either way. Depends on your interpretation of Egyptian history, how you take that. Verse 19. The same dealt subtly with our kindred, and evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children to the end that they might not live. So, of course, we know the story how they were casting out and killing the male babies. They were throwing them into the river. Verse 20, in which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. Verse 21, and when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. Of course, we know the story about Moses, who's going to be the great deliverer, how his parents hid him. They finally put him out. They did throw him in the river. They just put him in a boat when they did. And so they put him in a little basket in the river, and Pharaoh's daughter finds him, he now, though, is raised as her own. Now, of course, he was still raised in his parents' house thanks to his sister being there and some quick thinking on her part. His mother still raised him and nursed him. So he knew who he was. He knew about being an Israelite, but he was raised in Egypt, in the palace, and trained and basically as Jewish royalty. And verse 22, and Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. Verse 23, and when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. Verse 24, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, and he defended him, and avenged him that he was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian. Verse 25, for he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. Now, it's very interesting here. I think Moses knew he was supposed to be the deliverer. Now, whether God revealed that to him, or he just kind of looked at the circumstances and, kind of realized, everything kind of points to me being the guy. Because he's one of the few male people from Israel, around his age, because they were killing all the rest of them. So, and he's, all these practical reasons, he's been trained. He knows how to fight. He knows how to be a warrior. He's been trained to be a leader. He can work to get his people out. And I think he really tried to do this in his own power here, and it blew up in his face. I think he really expected to lead some type of a slave rebellion right here. And instead of people rallying behind him, they rejected him, verse 26. And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again. So he sees two Jews fighting each other, saying, sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one to another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, who made thee a ruler and a king over us? Verse 28, wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? So verse 29, then fled Moses at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begat two sons. So Moses realizes, look, I've blown it. He runs out of town. It's not quite like in the movies where he's kicked out. He just runs out. And hides out in the wilderness. He is there for years and years. He marries, has a family, and basically has left and forsook that old life and even his identity. Verse 30, and when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. Verse 31, Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight, and as he drew near to behold it, the voice of the Lord came unto him, saying, verse 32, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses trembled and durst not behold. Verse 33, Then said the Lord to him, Put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. Verse 34, I have seen the affliction of my people which is in Egypt, and have heard their groaning, and am come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send thee into Egypt. So the time has come, you know, that is promised to Abraham. The time has come for the Jews to come out. God is now going to use Moses, but Moses is not too ready. Verse 35. This Moses whom they refused, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge? This same did God send to be a ruler and deliver by the hand of the angel which appeared to him in the bush. Verse 36, He brought them out after that he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. So Moses leads the people out, of course, after the plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea, all those great stories you heard in Vacation Bible School and Sunday School that, all the children's books have. So, you know, it really kind of breaks up some monotony here. It's really kind of funny. Can you imagine you're put on trial in America for speeding? Let's say you got a speeding ticket and you challenge it, you go to court, and the judge says, well, what do you have to say for yourself? And you say, back in the 1770s, our fathers decided that a new nation must be born, that separation from Britain was the only choice. And George Washington, and John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson, and Ben Franklin, and John Hancock, and a host of other men led the formation of our new nation, which carried on and expanded with the annexation of Texas. And then there was a civil war. And, you know, rehashing all this, can you imagine? I wonder what the people were, just like in a courtroom, like everybody saying, okay, this is nice, we like history, but when are you going to get to the point when you actually going to defend yourself? I wonder what this audience thought of Stephen's message. Are they sitting there thinking, okay, this is good, but would you please get to defending yourself? This is a great history lesson. I don't know. You know, there's this principle in the debate or in arguments and stuff where you get somebody agreeing with you. It's also using salesmanship, too. Where you get somebody to start agreeing with you. If you get them in the habit of agreeing, you can slip something in and they will just naturally agree to it because they're used to and in the mode of agreeing with everything. So it could be, you know, something like that. It could be that they are just on the edge of their seat because they just love their own history and they're eating this up. As I say, basically what Stephen is doing is setting up this long history of Israel, just to prove that God has had issues with Israel through the years, and he's really going to start getting that point home here. So, verse number 37, we're going to see Israel was rebellious from the very beginning. Verse 37, this is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, and this is from Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15, 18, and 19, according to my Schofield reference here. A prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall ye hear. This is he that was in the church in the wilderness, which the angel which spake to him in the Mount Sinai, and with our fathers who received the lively oracles to give unto us. So Moses, he starts saying, Moses prophesied about a prophet. Now, who was that prophet? That prophet is the Messiah, that is Jesus Christ. And he shows that Jesus Christ was at work even back then. Verse 39, to whom our fathers would not obey, but thrust him from them, and in their hearts turned back again to Egypt. Of course, you know, they did that numerous times. They always wanted to go back, you know, just face some little hardship. They'd get a hangnail. Oh, I wouldn't get a hangnail if I was back in Egypt, you know. They'd get out there, well, we have water in Egypt. We don't have water now. And they kept longing to go back to their old life. They forgot they were slaves. They forgot that their babies were being killed. They wanted to go back to that, though. And, you know, that's kind of human nature. Even us as humans, we keep wanting to go back to the old ways and think, well, you know, this Christian life's too hard. Boy, it sure was a whole lot easier when I didn't have to get up on Sunday morning and go to church. We do the exact same thing. It's just, it's human nature. So, verse 40, the people have turned their heart back to Egypt. Verse 40, saying unto Aaron, make us gods to go before us. As for this Moses, which brought us out of the land of Egypt, we wot not. There's that word again I can't pronounce. We wot not what is becoming him. So Moses was up in the mountain, and they said, look, he's been up there too long. He's probably dead. The mountain goat probably knocked him off a cliff. So, you know, let's just make us some new gods. Forget about him. Let's forget about those plagues and that Red Sea. That was just coincidence, natural phenomenon. And let's just move right along. So, Aaron, you're the kind of priest guy. Just make us something new to worship. So verse 41, and they made a calf in those days and offered offered sacrifice unto the idol and rejoiced in the works of their own hands. So even in the midst of all these miracles God has performed and the mighty works that he has done, they still are turning to other gods. They still will not follow the true God, Jehovah. So verse 42, then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven. As is written in the book of the prophets, and this is Amos chapter 5, verse 25 through 27 here, that is being quoted. O ye house of Israel, have ye offered to me slain beasts and sacrifices by the space of 40 years in the wilderness? Yea, ye took up the tabernacle of Molech, and the star of your god Rimpham, figures which ye made to worship them, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. Our fathers had the tabernacle. We'll leave off right there. Verse 43. So, even in spite of everything that's going on, they still turned away. In spite of all the goodness God had towards the nation of Israel, they still kept turning away. If they had a good king, they might worship God for a while, but yet they still turned away. Even when they got to the land, they still turned away. Just it is constantly where the nation of Israel rejected God and wanted to worship their own gods, wanted to do their own thing. They kept rebelling against God. Verse 44, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness as he had appointed, speaking unto Moses that he should make it according to the fashion that he had seen. So they, you know, so we have the witness there of the tabernacle that God gave Moses the design. They built it. They have that witness of the tabernacle, of the services there, the symbolism, the types of all the services and the furniture and everything there. They had that, okay? Now, that kind of transitions into our next section here. We're going to see that Israel was rebellious in the place of God's blessing. They're going to get they're going to get their land. They're going to get a temple, and yet they still reject God. So verse 45, which, talking about the tabernacle, which also our fathers that came after brought in with Jesus into the possession of the Gentiles, whom God drave out before the face of our fathers unto the days of David. Okay. Side note here. I have heard some people say in verse 45 that this meant that Jesus Christ led the people into the land of Canaan and, you know, drove the people out. Okay. Is that a true statement? Yeah, it is. God definitely was at work in getting the nation of Israel into the land, and the miracles from the walls of Jericho to the sun standing still. Listen, God was definitely with them. God was definitely leading the nation of Israel. But this verse is not saying that Jesus Christ led them in. And we had an evangelist in our church a few years ago that wanted to make a big point about this. And I'll be honest with you, he was dead wrong. Because when the word there, the name Jesus, is talking about Joshua. Now, how do we know that? Because Joshua, Jesus, let's go in this. Jesus and Joshua are the same name in Hebrew, Yeshua. They are the same, or from the same root. They are very similar. It is the name Yeshua. Now, when you translate Yeshua into Greek, it becomes Jesus. And Jesus, when it is translated into English, becomes Jesus. Doesn't sound very similar, but it comes out that way. And when this verse says Jesus, it is talking about Joshua. The Greek word is Jesus, but it is definitely talking about Joshua leading the children of Israel into the land of Canaan. Now, you could make a case for that, I guess, just at face value. Say, well, it says Jesus, it must be Jesus Christ. However, do a little study. This is not the only time the name Jesus appears in the New Testament where it does not refer to Jesus Christ. If you want to flip over to the to Paul's books, I don't have the references right here in front of me, but you will find that there's at least one other guy named Jesus. And it's not talking about Jesus Christ. It was a very, very common name at the time. And it is just the name Yeshua in Hebrew, or the Greek Jesus. So that's all that is. Don't make more out of that than it is. Had he said right there that Jesus Christ had led the children of Israel into the land of Canaan, that would be the end of the sermon. It would end right there, because they would have him on blasphemy charges right there. Even though I believe that is a true statement, you know, but had he said that, those Jews would not have liked that. They would not have accepted it. They would have stopped him and stoned him right there. They knew what he said. He said Joshua led the children of Israel there. So, sorry to chase a little rabbit there, but that idiot evangelist really made me mad that said that. And I've kind of, every time I come across that, I've got to rant a little bit. And yes, I did call him an idiot evangelist on purpose. So, Joshua led the men to the possession of the Gentiles. Gentile means a non-Jew. So, and God drove out those non-Jews, the people of Canaan, the Canaanites, out. And basically, you know, they were still repossessing land. Then finally, under David, they have a unified rule. And so, talking about David, verse 46, who found favor before God and desired to find a tabernacle for the God of Jacob. Remember, David wanted to build the temple, and God would not let him. He said, look, you're a man of war. You have too much blood on your hands. I think it's very likely people would have looked at that as David's great monument to himself. God would not allow that to happen. This would not be, God didn't want to be the God of the conquering David. God wanted to be the great God Jehovah. He wanted to be separate from those battles. He is not a warrior God. Even though he did command wars, even though he did help the armies of Israel, he was not just a God of war. God was a God. God's also a God of peace. God is also a God of love. God is just. He is not going to be just the God of war. So that could be why that took place there. But of course, David could not. So David left instructions and accumulated all the material needed for Solomon, his son, to do the task. So verse 47, but Solomon built him an house, of course, which was the first temple. So verse number 48, howbeit, the Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands, as saith the prophet. Verse 49, and this is from Isaiah 66, Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will ye build me, saith the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Hath not my hand made all these things? So they wanted to build God a temple, but God is a spirit. God is larger than the universe. Cannot contain God. He study out when it talks about how big God is, how he could measure things in the palm of his hand. And God is so far beyond what can be contained in just a temple. God is not contained to one place and one structure. Now, God was showing them their folly in thinking that God would be in just in this one place. But as even God says, look, didn't I make all this stuff? You're making this thing to honor me, but didn't I make that rock? Didn't I make that wood? You know, you didn't make any of that. I did. You're just reassembling it because I made everything. I made all those little atoms there. All right, so we finally have got up. The temple's built. We are now through with our history lesson of Israel. So verse 51, now that he has give the most lengthy introduction imaginable, you know, going through, I don't know, 1,000 years or something of Israel's history. He's now finally going to get to a point. Verse 51. Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, ye do always resist the Holy Ghost as your fathers did, so do ye. So basically what Stephen has shown throughout this sermon is just, hey, look, Israel has always had an issue following God, and guess what, guys? It's no different now. You guys out there, you Sanhedrin, you Jewish rulers, you priests, you still have the same problem. You're still rebellious. You calls them stiff-necked. That, you know, that's they're hard-headed. They're stuck in their ways. They're resistant to change. Uncircumcised in heart and ears means that they're not separated. There's nothing holy about it. It's not talking about, you know, like something actually cut off there. You know, it's just in a spiritual sense there, that there's nothing different about. They're still in their natural state, unregenerate in the way that they feel and the way that they act. So verse number 52, which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted? I imagine this must have got them. So, you know, look back at history. Name me one prophet that people didn't get mad at. Name me one prophet that they didn't try to stone or kill or run out of town. Look at it. Isaiah, tradition says the king Manasseh sawed him in half. Jeremiah was thrown in jail. You can go on and on. The prophets were always being persecuted. You know, they mocked Elisha for being bald-headed. No matter who it was, they still did not. These prophets that they claimed to honor and reverence as a great men of God they were, their forefathers rejected them too and wouldn't listen. Continuing there, and they have slain them which showed before of the coming of the Just One. That's capital letters, Just One there. That's talking about the Messiah. Of whom ye have been now the betrayers and murderers. So not only have they betrayed the prophets, they also have betrayed the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And notice they're the betrayers, that they have rejected him, they murderers. They not only reject him, they put him to death. That's the ultimate rejection there. Verse 53, who have received the law by the dispositions of angels and have not kept it. So basically says, look at how lofty an origin the Israel's had. Look how God has worked. Look how God looked at the nation of Israel, blessed them, and worked in them like no other people. He gave them the tabernacle. He gave them the law. He wanted them to be a witness to the world, and they did not do it. In fact, they rejected it. They have not kept it. So, we can imagine to the staunch Jewish rulers who are gathered there, ready to lynch Stephen, they didn't like this. Verse 54. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed on him with their teeth. So it got them. They're convicted. He hit them right between the eyes. You know, they're convicted. They're angry. They're gnashing on him with their teeth. I can see them. They got their teeth clenched. You can't see me doing that, but I know you can hear the difference there. They got their teeth clenched. I can imagine they're growling, oh, we're going to get this guy. I can't believe he said that. I can see they are mad at Stephen. Verse 55. Now, this is very curious here. We're going to see Stephen's theophany here. Stephen is going to get a glimpse of heaven here, verse 55. In the midst of all this turmoil, in the midst of all these people that are this mob that is about to kill him, Stephen's going to get just a little glimpse of what's awaiting him. Verse 55. But he, being full of the Holy Ghost, looked up steadfastly into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing on the right hand of God. So it's just as if God opened the window to heaven and said, Stephen, you're coming home, son. You know, we're ready and waiting for it. Now, it's interesting here. He sees the glory of God. So he's seeing the throne of God there. But he says that Jesus is standing on the right hand of God. That's very interesting. In the other depictions of heaven, Jesus is always sitting. Why is he standing here? The reason why, I believe, is because he is standing to greet Stephen. Stephen is groundbreaking in that he is the first martyr. He is the first person that is going to give his life for the cause of Christ. And Jesus is going to personally greet him. Now, I don't know. Maybe Stephen's not special in getting that treatment. I would not be shocked at all as if any martyr that gets to enter the pearly gates and enter into the glory land does not get a similar reception. But I think that's why Jesus is standing, because he is standing to greet his child that is coming home because of his faith. Verse 56, and said, this is Stephen speaking. Nobody else can see this. Stephen's just looking up. And verse 56, and said, behold, I see the heavens open and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. So they knew what that meant. They didn't wonder who the Son of Man was. They knew he was talking about Jesus. He just said Jesus that they hate, that they killed, is in heaven at the highest place of honor at the right hand of God. So verse 57, of course, they did not like it. And then they cried out with a loud voice and stopped their ears and ran upon him with one accord. So they are mad. Can you imagine? They're screaming. They don't want to hear it anymore. It's like, no more. Just quiet. No, no. I can hear them screaming. Enough, enough. Away with him. And they actually are covering up their ears. They don't want to hear anymore. They're sticking the palms of their hands over their ears. No, no. You know, kind of like you do, you know, a little kid does when they don't want to listen to you. You know, they stick their hands in there. No, 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 no. And they start kind of singing themselves. You know, that's what these guys are doing. These grown men are screaming that they don't want him. They're covering up their ears. Oh, no more. We don't want to hear anymore. And verse 58, and cast him out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at a young man's feet whose name was Saul. Now, the stoning process, he's basically, this is kind of a mob deal. I can't see that the actual sentence was passed, but stoning was the common form of execution for the Jews for someone of this nature for a religious type crime. They would be taken outside the city, never in the city. You always took them outside the city. It was kind of a dishonored thing also. Take them outside the city. This group of men would just start picking up rocks and chunking them at the victim until he just would be bludgeoned to death by these rocks. And it's one of those things, kind of like a firing squad. You know, who knows which bullet actually killed the guy. They get a little bit of innocence and anonymity there because everybody was throwing rocks. So who knows which one actually did him in. It's kind of a societal punishment that's being passed here. So they pick up stones, they kill Stephen. And then we also have there at the end of verse 58, our first appearance of Saul of Tarsus, who we will come to know as Paul the Apostle. We see that they were laying their clothes at his feet, at a young man's feet. Now, Saul was an up-and-comer in the ranks of the Pharisees. He is very energetic. He has a great future ahead of him. If, you know, they had a who's who of Pharisees, he would be in the list. If everyone, I can imagine if they stayed up at night discussing things like, you know, who's going to be the next great Pharisee? Who's going to be the next great Jew? Paul probably was mentioned because this guy was an up-and-comer. Now, what was he doing here? They laid down their clothes at his feet. So as they were going, of course, now the Jewish clothes, it's not like they stripped down naked or anything. They actually would throw off their outer garment, that outer cloak, just for the freeness of movement. They actually did still have clothes on underneath that, but they cast off their outer robe, and pile them up at Saul's feet. Now, what is that? What is it doing? That is basically his showing his approval. He's basically kind of overseeing, like, all right, guys, we're going to do this. We're going to do this right. You throw your coach right here, and let's go get them. And so in a way, he's kind of taking an amount of responsibility for the death of Stephen there, even though there's no account of him actually ever throwing a stone at him. He is showing his agreement and taking part in it and watching over the men's coats that do so. In verse 59, and they stoned Stephen, calling upon God, saying — that's not the people calling on God, that's Stephen calling upon God — saying, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." And in the midst of the rocks that are flying, and I can imagine the cursing that's going on from these men, verse 60, and he kneeled down and cried with a loud voice, "Lord, lay not this sin to their charge." And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Sounds very familiar. Doesn't that sound like what Christ said on the cross? Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Here is Stephen in the midst of being wrongly accused and viciously killed. Yet in the midst of all that, there's no gall in him. There's no anger in him. He's praying to God to forgive the people that are doing it, that they just did not understand what they were doing. Now, what were they doing? They were taking out their anger against God, against Christ, on Christ's messenger, Stephen. You know, we as Christians, we are just kind of pawns in this game. When the world hates us, it's not that they just hate us. They hate God, and they take out their anger on us. They hate God's law. They hate God's book. They hate God's son. And God's not here to invisibly to take that type of hatred. So who is the visible manifestation of God to be shown, shining his light? It is Christians. It is his people. And so when they attack God, they attack us. And that's what happened to Stephen there. Their hatred of Christ, their hatred of the church, was taken out on Stephen. And for the first time, it went so far as to have blood shed. Now, we've had the apostles arrested. We've had them even beaten. But now, we've actually had the first person to give up their life for this new faith. And, you know, really from here on, as far as history goes, the persecution only gets worse. Now, in the book of Acts, there's not necessarily a bunch more people who are going to give their life. But if you get a book like Fox's Book of Martyrs, read the accounts. Now, historically, some of them may be a tad bit exaggerated, but there are some that are flat or not. Read about some of the stuff Nero did to the Christians after the Great Fire in Rome. Most of that is not taken out of context. You can read about people such as Polycarp that gave their life. People burned at the stake, heads chopped off, other just grievous tortures that men and women have gone through throughout the ages because of their faith. And the very first one of those was Stephen. So really, especially with early history, martyrdom is so attached to the early history of the church that here at the early stages, the church only 3, 4, 5, something maybe years old, and the first martyr takes place. And he's just the first in a long line of many that still continues today. Maybe not in the United States of America, but throughout the world, people are still giving their life because of the faith that they hold. Well, I'm glad that actually took less than an hour. I'm actually kind of proud of myself for getting through it. I know we skimmed through a bunch pretty quick, but I'm assuming that you are familiar with much of the Old Testament history that we covered, of Abraham and Joseph and Moses and David. I hope that you're already familiar with that. If not, I mean, just the seventh chapter to really cover it all to someone who's not familiar, probably I'd have to split this into four or five lessons at least to cover everything. So I know we kind of rocketed through a bunch of that, but I think we're able to hit the high points and at least give a good grasp of what's being said and what was going on. So we will leave off there. And our next couple lessons, we will focus on another of the deacons. We will focus on Philip. And in the midst of persecution that comes, and the Christianity is going to be spread, and Philip is going to have a pretty big role in preaching the gospel and reaching a bunch of new people. A couple of famous episodes we'll talk about involving him. Well, we'll call it a lesson there. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. If you enjoyed the lesson, there's other lessons in the Baptist Basics University series, not only in the Book of Acts, there's also the Book of John, some other ministry type ones that are going on. You can find them at baptistbasics.org/BBU. You can also find the podcast feed on iTunes, which has all of these lessons. And when they're put up, I add them to that feed so you can get them about as quick as possible. And the easiest way to do it is through iTunes or another program like that to download podcasts. So anyway, if you enjoy it, let me know about it. You can find more about BaptistBasics.org at the website, BaptistBasics.org. You can send me an email. There's a Facebook page. I have a Twitter account I don't do much with, but it's at Baptist Basics. So you can kind of keep up with some news and announcements there also. And anyway, we'll call that a lesson. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening, and we'll catch up with you in the next lesson.